Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
From our studios at KUOM on the West Bank of the University of Minnesota campus, this is Culture Q, the art show that rocks.
This week on Culture Q, North by Midwest. Good evening, Culture Q listeners. For those of you who weren't able to make it down to Austin for South by Southwest, like us, don't fret. We'll be producing our own cultural menagerie.
It's a veritable festival of sound here on Culture Q as we head to the local bars and underground providers of music.
We'll also be looking at upcoming movies in 2012 and proposed legislation in Minnesota. But first, we check out the Twin Cities' own secret stash of music.
Secret Stash Records is a local independent record label specializing in high-quality reissues of international music albums. Culture Q producer Tess Weinberg uncovers the secret of Secret Stash.
I'm in a room full of volunteers at 7 o'clock on a Monday night in Uptown. We're kind of in assembly line fashion, and my job is to put the newly pressed vinyl into their jackets. I'm at the headquarters of Secret Stash Records helping assemble their newest album, but we'll get back to that.
What do you do here at Secret Stash, Eric?
We find these kind of weird, rare old recordings.
This is Eric Foss, one of the co-founders of Secret Stash Records, along with his friend Corey. Eric is kind of the big picture guy.
The big picture.
Yeah.
The big picture vision for everything.
And they focus on
kind of lost and forgotten groove-based music from around the world. We license the rights to them, and then we manufacture them exclusively on vinyl and distribute them.
An international music record label based here in Minneapolis may seem like a strange pairing.
Why a record label and why Minneapolis?
But for Eric,
To me, it doesn't feel like it's a risk. It's almost like the easy thing. Like, well, this is all I've ever done.
But as we all know, the environment will always have an effect on the product.
We are very much a product of our environment.
They run their business in a really unique way. They have events like assembly parties
and things like that, where it's really more about a community.
He attributes this to the Minnesota Nice.
I don't know. That's just how we do things here. I think Minneapolis is an incredible place right now that it's palpable. You can feel it, that there's like this energy that everyone here is focused on local goods, local food, local art, local entertainment, and that people here just happen to be doing things very well. So it's
contagious.
Look, if Corey and I had grown up in Chicago, Milwaukee, New York, San Francisco, you name anywhere but here, yeah, I would probably still be running a label, but it wouldn't be the label that it is now.
So there's this really intense
local energy
that really helps their process.
So when we release records, we have to have them manufactured by a third party.
So the vinyl's pressed in Nashville, the jackets are from California, and those plastic bags that the whole album comes in, which I learned are called dust bags, are from...
From some vendor in Ohio or some New York or some, I don't know where they are.
And then the stickers and download cards are done locally. So all of these elements are shipped back to them, and then they put them together to create what you would buy in the store. And to do this, they need help. Help from volunteers.
I'm helping package and put together these records for resale.
This is Mark, a new volunteer at Secret Stash.
And I'm having a wonderful time. I met some people and we've been talking.
And this seemed to be the general consensus of this assembly party. It was a lot of people's first experience, and everyone seemed to be having a really good time.
I find it to be a lot of fun, a lot of really cool people.
And it's been fun.
I enjoyed the community.
I think it's been wonderful.
Great experience,
and it's really fun.
That's what we're doing right now.
When you go to volunteer at Secret Stash, they'll give you a free limited edition album of that album that they're releasing, and then all the free local beer and pizza that you can eat.
I'm willing to work for some beer and pizza and free vinyl. What the heck?
So, Secret Stash uses volunteers because by cutting out that middleman, they can afford to put out high-quality, low-edition albums. Basically, cheap labor.
Cheap labor.
This is John, a new volunteer as well. He was standing across from me at the packaging table.
I'm sure that's probably a big part of it, but it's a cool way to get like-minded people together who support this sort of thing. You know, it's a good vibe.
People who actually care about the music they are packaging are now handling the records, ensuring for a cared-for, special product. Or at least this is what Eric believes.
It goes back to the idea of community, that now the records are like made in Minneapolis in a sense, and there's that energy going into the product.
In my experience with volunteering, it doesn't really go very well. You know, people will do it for a while and then get bored, and there's nothing holding them there, so why stick around? But with Secret Stash, all the volunteers seem to really care, and it works.
I just think that people come and they get sort of a peek behind the curtain, if you will, and they meet a lot of interesting people that maybe they wouldn't have met on a normal Monday night.
And this is true. I definitely met people that I wouldn't have normally met on a Monday night. A documentary maker, an accountant for Best Buy, few DJs, some record fanatics. And all these volunteers just keep coming back.
If you give beer to people, they're pretty happy.
Secret Stash's newest release is called
The Body Music.
And it's by a band named
Afrofunk.
Recorded in London back in 1975. All of the music you've heard today is from that album. If you like what you heard, go to
secretstashrecords.com.
Or if you want to get involved,
Facebook, Twitter, YouTube.
You know the drill. For Culture Q, I'm Tess Weinberg.
Now that the Oscar season is finally over, audiences are ready to look forward to new releases in 2012. In our top 7 this week, Alex Mertens previews some of these films.
2012. Another year, another set of movie releases. There's so much coming out this year. How on earth do you know where to start? Zombies, love stories, zombie love stories. The possibilities are endless. I'm going to take a few moments of your life now and talk about 7 films that seem to be rising just over the horizon. I'm not saying they're good, I'm not saying they're bad, but I will say what I think about them. The first film I'm going to talk about is The Great Gatsby. The Great Gatsby is one of my favorite books of all time, and seeing a movie version can polarize me. Talent-wise, it really could go either way. The leads are strong overall. Leonardo DiCaprio definitely has the making of the character of Jay Gatsby, though Tobey Maguire as Nick Carraway could be tricky. That said, since Nick is an awkward third wheel for most of the story, it might work out in Maguire's favor. Overall, there is potential. However, when adapting one of the best works of American literature, the potential for messing up is ridiculously high and really more likely. Let's face it, if there's one thing that Hollywood isn't good at, it's subtlety. Of course, I'll still see it. Next up on the chopping block is the most anticipated movie of the year, Titanic in 3D. Right? I mean, after all, I've always thought that the way to get more involved with the story of Titanic is to throw a huge gimmick in order to gouge a few more bucks out of me. It really all seems quite cynical for James Cameron to release what was, at one time, the highest-grossing film of all time. Not that it doesn't make sense financially. After all, why not make it a record holder again by not only re-releasing it, but re-releasing it with an extra $5 on the ticket price? Cameron's already proved that selling a half-baked story with a lame gimmick was a goldmine. The same theory seemed to ring true for Mr. Lucas in re-releasing the first of the Star Wars prequel trilogy, The Phantom Menace, also in 3D. Why he felt this was necessary is well beyond me. To my knowledge, no one actually wants to see Jar Jar Binks any closer than a galaxy far, far away. Next up comes Dark Knight Rises. Following up on The Dark Knight could either be a challenge for Christopher Nolan, or a cakewalk. On the one hand, the stellar performance of the late Heath Ledger in Dark Knight will be nearly impossible to beat. However, the ungainly length of Dark Knight, coupled with some only half-developed characters and a lackluster finale, could make Dark Knight Rises shine by comparison. Not that Nolan is in trouble. It seems that any film he touches turns to awesome, and even the convoluted mess that is the Batman canon hasn't dampened his magic. The pedigree behind The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, is really beyond reproach. Peter Jackson already proved just what he's capable of with The Lord of the Rings, and there are few doubts as to the quality of The Hobbit. There really isn't much to say. He's got the cast, the location, and no doubt the same massively dramatic and impeccable aesthetic behind him. That said, some problems do arise due to the simple fact that it's a book adaptation. Let's face it, the Lord of the Rings trilogy had a lot cut out of them. Even the extended versions were missing a fair few points that the book had. That said, I honestly doubt Peter Jackson will fail us. J.R.R. Tolkien seems to be just where he belongs. I'd be curious to see if he decides to make the Silmarillion after this. I'd give it 50-50. Prometheus is something of a strange choice to look into. Then a friend revealed to me that it's actually an Alien prequel. This intrigued me. The Xenomorph has been kind of ruined over time. Let's face it, the only two movies in the series that are worth a damn are the first two. The trailer is really similar to the original Alien trailer, which, in a way, is a little pretentious. That said, it is still Ridley Scott, which is a good sign. Probably one of the most anticipated teen releases for this year is The Hunger Games. The film, based on the book by Suzanne Collins, seems to have a lot going for it, as fans are already buzzing. I haven't read it, but a few of my friends have it, and they love it. Sounds like a wonderfully psychotic tale about barely pubescent kids killing each other in a battle royale deathmatch. What could possibly go wrong? We've finally come to this. The last, the final, the end of Stephanie Meyer's execrable series of bastardized vampire lore. It's been a long road that literally drove its lead actor insane. Though it's obviously a mass media phenomena, it doesn't change the fact that it's just a terrible story. There are plenty more movies coming out in 2012, and this really only is scratching the surface. Hopefully it won't disappoint nearly as much as I think it's going to. This has been the Top 7. Thanks for listening.
Of our five senses, sound and taste might not seem to have that much in common. But if you ever find yourself at a fast food joint that blasts the Muzak or a dead quiet mom and pop restaurant, this story by Culture Q producer Noel Clark might help you make the connection.
Music can make or break a dining experience. Imagine the most awkward dinner you've ever had. A few things might be wrong here. Maybe the food's no good, maybe your company is boring, or it's completely and totally quiet.
No, music is everything. I sing to you my
melodies, Blackbird. That's Ashley Gold, a local singer-songwriter. She and her band are regular late-night performers at the Dakota Jazz Club. Events like Foodie Night pair live music with a carefully selected menu by the Dakota's head chefs. For Ashley, it's an opportunity to reach out and touch an entirely new audience.
Because that stage at the Dakota is so intimate, because people are really like, you could lean in and grab a french fry and dip it and eat it and then take a sip of their wine and be like, oh, that was really good. And if the light is in the air, put
your hands up, get your hands up. Martina Priyadka, general manager at the Dakota, explains it this way.
Rather than kind of that theater style, choose your seat and buy a ticket for it as well as have dinner, it's more of a drop-in, relaxed, regular restaurant with live music.
But not all jazz fans are looking for pommes frites and goat cheese flan.
We've had some struggles with people being more music-driven when they come here and not as focused on the food. So we have had comments that maybe we shouldn't have the quality food we have. But it is a heartfelt goal of both of the owners that they equal each other.
But what about people who focus on food for a living?
My name is Kian. I write for foodstoned.com, and I also write for a local web magazine called Twin Cities Food Finds.
Aside from cooks, management, and wait staff, food writers are probably the closest thing to professional diners. But do they notice the music?
I bet it's one of those things where if you were in that sort of environment, you might not notice what it was, but I think you would recognize that something wasn't quite right.
For Kian, a dining experience that has just enough music to be pleasant, but not so much music that it's intrusive, is the right way to go.
There should be a good mix, and that's something I think a restaurant should take into account, you know, as, you know, test your levels, check what you're doing, you know. Ask, you know, if you ask your customers, is the music too loud? There's nothing wrong with that. Or is it not loud enough?
When putting together a bar or restaurant, music might not be the first thing on the menu.
One of the things that a lot of our operators oftentimes get wrong is the music, where that's where we come in and sort of advise them.
That's why people like Andy from the consulting firm Shea are here to help.
A lot of them just think you plug and play. You know, you just subscribe, push the button for soft rock, and you're good to go. But there's really a lot to look at and take in to make sure that you're fitting the full experience.
This isn't always the case. There are diamonds in the rough that know how important music is to their customers and staff and make no apologies for their taste.
Should I rock and roll it in soundbite form? I'm Kermit Carter. I'm one of the managers here at the Triple Rock Social Club in lovely Minneapolis, Minnesota.
The Triple Rock is a Minneapolis bar, restaurant, music venue mashup known for its punk rock clientele, killer weekend brunches, and of course, free bacon night. At the T-Rock, the power to choose the tunes lies with the patrons and their trusty bartenders.
I am not very much into black metal, but some bartenders are. I'm way more into the Beach Boys than, say, most of the bartenders, but, you know, if a Beach Boys song occasionally pops up, that's great.
The centerpiece of the Triple Rock is the jukebox, a dimly lit silver machine with everything from Wu-Tang Clan to Queen.
We do have a jukebox here at the bar that we're very proud of and also very protective of.
A faded, handwritten note, scotch taped to the front of the jukebox, reads, "Track 00 plays all songs in order until credits are used. You have been warned. Do not complain to the bartender."
We absolutely do want to provide a place where they can come in and hear what they want to hear. But if they want to hear Taylor Swift, for example, yeah, you can listen to that on Spotify at home. But everybody else should probably just be excited to hear NWA into Bad Brains. That seems like a better plan to me.
Whether it's settling down for some grilled gem lettuce and jazz, or rocking out with free bacon and Bad Brains, it seems like the trick is to find a balance. So be sure to pair your food and tunes responsibly. For Culture Q, I'm Noel Clark.
For tonight's question of the week, new reporter Spencer Dorr asks passers-by what the first album they ever bought was.
First record would be Pink Floyd, The Wall.
Probably Michael Jackson, Thriller.
It was 50 Cent's Black Magic.
Moving Pictures by Rush.
Backstreet Boys, maybe?
J.J. Lin's first album. He's from Singapore, and he's a great singer, I think.
It was Snivelization by Orbital.
International Super Hits by Green Day.
My answer is really embarrassing, and I was 10, and I'm pretty sure it was Now One.
I think Shania Twain.
It's a Chinese album from Jeju.
The Eminem Show.
Mine was probably NSYNC, back in the 90s.
It was Dave Matthews Band, Live at Red Rocks.
That'd be the Lion King soundtrack.
Led Zeppelin 4.
Aerosmith, Get a Grip.
Linkin Park, Hybrid Theory.
I don't even remember mine, but if I had to guess, I'd probably say Aaron Carter, maybe.
That's embarrassing. Mine was Out of Time by R.E.M. on cassette tape.
Oh my gosh, I'm so old. This is gonna date me. Okay.
No, don't even worry about it.
LL Cool J, his very first album.
Raising Hell by Run DMC.
I don't know. I think it was, the tape, Celine Dion, the Titanic soundtrack.
I think it was decades ago. I think it was Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 5.
Unfortunately, it was probably Britney Spears in, like, second grade.
Probably was Janet Jackson with the Nasty song on it.
How about a 45?
It was a 45? Do you remember what the artist was?
The Angels, I believe, back in the 50s. I can't remember the name of the song, though. I know it was The Angels.
HF 2260 is a proposed bill in Minnesota which would ask Congress to extend military burial rights to Hmong veterans who served in the secret wars of the Vietnam War in Cambodia and Laos. Currently, these rights are denied because the Hmong soldiers were recruited and trained by the CIA and not the United States military. Reporter Mitch Skinner investigates the movement to change this.
The United States CIA has never been an organization to give up inside information, but when it comes to the so-called secret wars in Laos, little remains hidden from the general public.
This is the battlefield in Laos. These are government troops supported and financed by the United States, fighting and losing ground to communist troops, many of them from North Vietnam. Fighting in remote mountains in an obscure corner of Asia. It looks and sounds familiar.
That's why it is so baffling to many that while Hmong soldiers served under the CIA in the Vietnam War, they are not allowed military burial rights, even after becoming U.S. citizens.
Well, there's some confusion about whether or not you can determine if somebody actually was a member of the Hmong fighting community in northern Laos. There's documentation that shows who did what for the CIA.
That's Mark Brunswick, a staff writer with the Star Tribune, who has been following the proposed bill in Minnesota that would allow for Hmong soldiers to be buried in military cemeteries. He has looked at the issue both politically and from the personal perspective of both the Hmong community and Vietnam veterans.
It's pretty strict with the federal requirements that you have to actually be a United States veteran, honorably discharged, or a member of their family to be buried in national or state cemetery. So it may sound bureaucratic, but to a lot of people it means a lot.
Currently, the bill has no scheduled hearings, but the problem hasn't been veterans reacting against it. Brunswick says many have supported the bill.
Yeah, there are veterans legislative groups, which are groups, a combination of different groups that have testified in favor of the bill at the legislature and have been very vocal about supporting the idea that they get the burial right.
Despite support from many veterans, the bill has had trouble moving past the House of Representatives, but that doesn't mean it's dead. Eileen Herr is the executive director of the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. They're looking to reach out and gain community support for burial rights for Hmong soldiers.
We want to work with the community. We want to empower them. We want them to practice the full rights and privilege as an American citizen and an American resident. And so we want to find ways for the community to get what they want.
The Hmong community has had a hard time finding permanent homes since their exodus from Laos after the Vietnam War. However, Eileen Herr explained that the location of home isn't nearly so important as its culture.
So their definition of home is very different from your definition or my definition. The question is, why can't the Hmong people say America is home? America will be home when the Hmong people feel that they can practice their religion, their culture freely.
But she explained that the situation is different for the older Hmong generation from the generation raised in the U.S.
I think we've acculturated and adapted to a lot of American ways. And so for us, a lot of us think that this is our home. But the pendulum swings that as we get older, too, we think about cultural heritage, history, identity, and we want to pass that on to our children and who are speaking the Hmong language, who know the Hmong rituals and rites, and all of that is passing away.
And too often, subcultures aren't accepted in our society. For Asian Americans, there has historically been a battle against the forever foreign stereotype of being unable to assimilate into the mainstream. That problem is still very prevalent.
To a large extent, I think that has to do with skin color, because we do look foreign. I get that asked all the time, and then when I start speaking English, people always well, some are amazed that my English is so well. And I'm like, well, it should be because I came when I was in first grade.
And although Eileen Herr credits America for being more diverse than other nations, she believes we still have a long way to go in our beliefs in the American ideal.
In people's mind, they have an ideal of what an American is. An American is what you see reflected on the TV, in the media, and for the most part, it's a white person. And I think America has a long ways to go to say America is made of all different types of people.
While the decision to not allow Hmong soldiers to be buried in military cemeteries does not seem to be racially based, the fact remains that it is a policy that excludes a specific ethnic group. The Minnesota Veterans Affairs points out that passing the bill would set a precedent that would need to be extended to Iraqis, Somalis, Vietnamese, and other groups that also served for the United States in war efforts. Mark Brunswick pointed out that this is not as large of a problem as it may seem.
There actually is some precedent. There is Philippine soldiers who are permitted burial. So there is some precedent there. Also, the idea that it's expensive or going to require a lot of effort is by the day gets more minimal. As there's only about 400 Vietnam veterans from Laos, for instance, in Minnesota at this point, and it's likely about half of them would want to be buried in a veteran cemetery. So, you know, the costs are not that exceptional. It's probably about $800 a piece.
It's also worth pointing out that the only military benefits being sought for Hmong soldiers are burial rights, a final piece of land for a group so often unable to find any. But their service is already honored in a different way.
I should also point out that the Hmong soldiers who fought in Vietnam are very proud. My father was one of those soldiers, and he wears his fatigues proudly. His bomber jacket, he wears it proudly. He has great memories. That generation, my father's generation, pass on that love of America and country to their children. And so now we have so many young Hmong men and women in the U.S. military, National Guard, and Reserve. And so I'm very proud of them and the service that they rendered to this country.
With Culture Q, I'm Mitch Skinner.
Oh, beautiful, for spacious skies, for amber waves of green.
Well, Culture Q listeners, that's our show. This week, you heard stories from Tess Weinberg, Alex Mertens, Noel Clark, Spencer Doerr, and Mitch Skinner.
Producers for Culture Q are Noel Clark, Tess Weinberg, me, Mitch Skinner,
and me, Zach McCormick.
Hosts this week were Zach McCormick and Mitch Skinner.
Our regular host and managing editor is Mark Sheely.
You can find Culture Q on Facebook, Tumblr, and iTunes U.
Thanks for listening. Tune in next week.
Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.